Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the train.
Guy Smith is with us. He's a San Francisco-based writer, a political pundit, and a provocateur. He's the author of, listen to it, Shooting the Bull, A Modern Guide to Propaganda Analysis. Guy, hey, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be with you. I hear I'm broadcasting out of chilly Anchorage today.
Oh, well, you know, you could have been close about a year, about 4 years ago, but it's chilly Milwaukee, but it was close enough.
Well, as long as it's cold. I'm so used to being cold here in San Francisco, it would feel like home.
Oh, I got you loud and clear. As a matter of fact, I'm an old Southern Californian. I was in Fairbanks. I was in Alaska for about 20-some-odd years, and then I came back down south again, and it's an interesting place to be. But the one thing that stays constant between Alaska, Southern California, and the Midwest, Guy, is this thing called propaganda. And it's interesting because of all the years that I have watched political pundits do what they do and say what they say, it's almost like a soap opera. We expect it. We listen to them. We know that there's really not too much behind what they say. And at the same time, if we hear something that causes us to say, oh, they're going to give me that, we vote for them.
Well, and that's why I wrote Shooting the Bull. Everyone knows they're being lied to. Everyone knows they're being spun. And once in a while, the average person can recognize it. What I wanted to do was give people not only an end-to-end case study of how it's done in the modern age, but also give them a working lexicon. I call it the catalog of canards, whereby they can identify propaganda in real time and communicate it with their friends and their peers and their neighbors. Because the moment that you take the power out of a lie, the moment that you take misdirection away from the conversation, then we can corner the people who are doing the propaganda and make them ineffectual in political discussions.
Where I think we have gone wrong, and I say we as a nation have gone wrong, we look at everything that Obama tried to do, and obviously most of it has not been done. Promises that haven't been kept, I can go on and on with this. But the most important thing is with the sharpshooting of the Republicans back and forth and between each other, it gives Obama strength. And this guy might even get reelected again just because the Republicans, and I happen to be a Republican, are deluding themselves in the public eye.
It's interesting. The Republicans are experts at shooting their own toes off. It happens almost every presidential election cycle. They will begin sniping at each other with more vigor and more ammunition than they actually snipe at their opponents. Obama, I thought, was going to lay low, but I'm in the process of writing another article whereby I'm analyzing the propaganda that was unleashed the day after the Iowa caucuses. This seems to be a strategic mistake on their part, because the last thing that they should be doing is getting the Republicans to stop destroying themselves. What is interesting, though, and I'm going to wind this back a little bit, I think where things started to go wrong was the Motor Voter Act. You know, back when I was a kid, you know, in the Taft administration, you had to go across town to the public recorder or to a local courthouse, and you had to show some identification to prove who you were and that you were an adult, and then you could get your voter registration card. I'm so old, they even had me put my hand up in the air and swear an oath back then.
Sure.
With Motor Voter, you recruited a whole new flock of voters who don't have the gumption to drive a few blocks down the road to get their voter registration card. These type of voters are the ones who are most easily influenced by propaganda and by empty promises. I've always referred to Obama as the Motor Voter President because I don't think he could have gotten into office if it hadn't been for that block of voters. In fact, I like reminding people Obama got less than 53% of the popular vote. So he wasn't, you know, everyone's favorite choice to begin with.
No, no. And as a matter of fact, if we really take a look at it, you came up with a very important point. if he would have just stayed low. You know, now he's going to become a target again, and he won't help the Republicans dilute each other. And I really believe when it really comes down to it, we've become very lazy. And when it comes time that you or I don't have to go down and prove who we are to vote, I think we have a real problem there, because you've got a tremendous amount of people. Let's say you pick up one ethnicity, whatever that is, and Obama's saying, we're going to give you this, and you're going to get that, and we're going to be wonderful to you. Well, what's to stop them from coming in and voting 10, 15, 20, 100 times from precinct to precinct to precinct? We've already had it done. We saw what happened in Florida. In many, many cases, California, many, many cases where we're finding voter fraud. But does anybody do anything about it? No. But if we don't, if you can't prove who you are, you shouldn't be able to vote.
Well, that's an absolute truth. I went down to my precinct a couple of elections ago, and somebody had already voted using my name, and I'm pretty sure that I'm the only person with my name at my address. So that kind of bothered me. We put in the provisional ballot, but, you know, that does not take away the potential for voter fraud. If you look at what happened with what's his name? The former guy from Saturday Night Live. I never can remember his name anymore. He's now in the Senate. Massive irregularities in that election. Same thing happened out in Washington State. Votes suddenly appeared in precincts as if by magic. There's insufficient control currently in this country for anyone to believe that their vote counts.
No, absolutely. And I think one of the major mistakes that the president just made was bypassing Congress, starting to shoot Congress down. But we're dealing with a situation right now where somebody who's ever advising him, well, actually, we need to send him presents and have him keep advising him that way. But the point of contention is the things that we hear and the things that we say obviously are two different things in many cases. But it's at the stage of the game where he's taking over everything. He's becoming, quote unquote, the wonderful dictator. He doesn't need Congress. He doesn't need anybody. It's going to go his way. The problem is that we see it, and yet at the same time, guy, we don't do anything about it. And somebody will jump up. Who was it? I can't remember her name. It was something. She's an African-American Democratic strategist. And I remember her definition of a Republican very loud and clear about a month ago. Republicans are people who love guns and hate women. And they believe that.
My father is a Republican, and I think his wife would differ with that equation. what's interesting is that people in politics, the propagandists, what they do is they try to bias people's opinions in advance of making a rational decision. I spent 20 years in marketing high tech down here in Silicon Valley, so I understand that that's the essence of branding. And you bring up an interesting point, because I was afflicted with a New York Times piece the other day. Came from Andrew Rosenthal. And the point of his entire piece was that everything Republicans say has a racist undertone to it. And when you read through the article, you find out that it's just really a warm pile of effluvium, in that it never actually connects anyone saying anything racist, but he's accusing Republicans at every turn of having some sort of underlying racist metaphor or some other silliness like that. That, combined with what David Axelrod and some of the people in Obama's campaign did yesterday, is showing that they're trying to set up a series of about three or four memes, which is about all the average person can absorb in a short amount of time and keep in their head, of what they want people to believe about Republicans in general and about Mitt Romney in particular. And what I find interesting is that they're doing it in such a way as to bias the independent voters against Republicans as a party or as a group of ideologies, and also to try to pull Romney out of that pack and make him the anointed Republican nominee. And I'm intrigued by why they want Romney as the nominee. I have some theories about it, but I'm going to wait until they tip their hands a little bit more.
No, by the way, absolutely. They know exactly what they're doing. Let's go back to the prejudice, those things that go along with that. And I have to say it that way. When I left Alaska, I packed up and I hired this kid from the university there, And she's about 22, 23 years old. Typical college kid and heavy-duty progressive, yada, yada, same, same. And so, which is not wrong. That's the way she believes, and that's the way we should be in this country. You should be able to believe the way you want to believe. I remember I saw her in the market right before I left. And oh, I know when it was. I take it back. I know when it was. It was the second time. It wasn't when I left that time. It was the second time when Bush got reelected. Okay. So he gets reelected, and I saw her in the market, and I said, guess who got reelected? I smiled, and she looked at me, and I swear to you, she looked at me, guy, and she said, well, are you a baby killer? And I said, and my answer to her was, of course. So in my spare time, you want to know what else I do. But that's exactly what it was. I'm a Republican. I'm a baby killer. I'm a Republican. I hate blacks. I'm a Republican. Women should be yada, yada. This is ridiculous.
Well, and let me go ahead and tip my hand before I get this article posted. What happened was that two people from Obama's campaign made their post-Iowa statements. One of them clearly was trying to tie the entire Republican Party to the Tea Party and used the phrase extremist Tea Party agenda. This is a leveraging of the lie of fear, which in my book we call creating a false sense of fear in order to motivate people into action while easing them past critical thinking. And using words like extremist, tying that to the Tea Party, who is the bane of anyone left of center at the moment, especially the Democrats and the Occupy Wall Street people and whatnot like that, is, in effect, waving a red flag, trying to get the base motivated. It's trying to induce fear in their own base to make sure they come to the polls. And this is, I think, a very interesting little propaganda angle, because in CNN, just a day before the Iowa caucus, they had a large article talking about how Democrats who voted for Obama in 2008 are now feeling a little disenfranchised. They had high hopes for him, and they think that he's basically failed, and they may actually just stay home and sit on their thumbs come November. So the first act of Obama's propagandist is to try to get that base motivated by using fear. Other people in the Obama campaign went even further and said some just incredibly bizarre things. The campaign manager said, and I'm quoting, that the Republicans were going to vote to let Wall Street write its own rules, end Medicare as we know it, roll back gay rights, leave the troops in Iraq indefinitely, restrict a woman's right to choose, gut Social Security, and pay for more tax cuts for millionaires and corporations. I mean, that's a lot to spit out in one breath, but their campaign manager did.
Yeah, but wait, but there's one thing that you neglected, you eliminated through the whole thing at the very end, and a partridge on a pear tree.
Well, that and clubbing baby seals. I'm really surprised they dropped that one off the map.
Yeah, but you know I think is hysterical? But when we talk about the, quote-unquote, the campaign against Republicans and how horrible the Tea Party is, and they're a bunch of racists and they're Nazis and they're whatever, if you ever watch the Tea Party in a typical organized movement, they look like an ARP, AARP Sunday picnic. They're just a bunch of regular people who haven't really done anything to be an activist. They haven't stood in front of the voting booths with clubs in their hands. They haven't gone out and burnt things. They haven't done anything like most of the activists are doing, but yet they're the worst people in the world.
Well, let me tell you a little story. I'm not a Tea Party member because I try to keep independent-minded. It gives me the ability to go anywhere and observe anything. But I did go to two Tea Party rallies to try to make sure that I understood what was going on. One of the Tea Party rallies I went to, right up front, pumping his fist every time one of the speakers mentioned the word freedom, was this young black guy in a wheelchair. But hardly a racist gathering. I mean, he was out there in front. He was basically the cheerleader. The lesbian couple off to the side with their rainbow flag, you know, well, that just they're there to prove the Tea Party's homophobia. And coming up from the back, I think, was the most interesting person I saw. She was obviously kind of like middle, upper-income woman. She was in her 50s, and she had a snarl on her face, but she was carrying a sign that said, I am an angry Democrat. And they were all there because of one central unifying theme, which should really unify the whole country, which is that the government must obey. And obeying begins by obeying the Constitution. And we're basically seeing an administration here who uses the Constitution for personal hygiene instead of as the rule of law.
Absolutely. And when you really come, we're starting to run out of time, but when you really come down to it, if you want a definition of those people who aspire to any kind of political height, they are supposed to be a reflection of the public. It's supposed to be a mirror, and it's not that way. The power is supposed to trickle up, not trickle down.
Absolutely. And it was proven, if nothing else, by the way they ramrodded Obamacare through when 62% of the population said no, thank you.
No, got it loud and clear. Guy, we're just starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at, buy the book, and follow along with your blogs?
Best one is to go to GuySmith.org, and there's links to the book right on the landing page.
Wonderful. Hey, Guy Smith, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I really appreciate your time and what you're doing.
My pleasure. Take care.
Good night.
Such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
As America's schools are focusing more on social justice than, listen to the words, equal justice, are children being indoctrinated to accept the failed entitlement philosophies that have led to the financial crisis in Europe? Will our kids, listen to the question, will our kids be doomed to live in an overregulated welfare state? Our guest tonight, author and veteran, Dr. John Vandenberg, lived through the Nazi occupation of Holland and understands the unique economic opportunities that America offers those who are willing to work for success. And he's here tonight. He is the author of, again, From Tyranny to Freedom. And let's say, hi, how are you? John, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine, and thank you so much for being here. John, let's go back. What was it like to be in Holland? I know you were very young, but it was an experience that, my goodness, nobody should go through, but you did go through it. What was the world like in those days for you?
Well, Holland was a very peaceful country in 1940, and, you know, it's a country of wooden shoes and tulips and windmills, but all of a sudden, on May 10th, 1940, we heard sounds in the distance of bombs and noises, and we, as my father turned on the radio, we realized we had been invaded by the Nazis. And 4 days later, when my father was downtown at work, the bombardment started, and he came running home after that with his dark suit all white from the dust from fallen buildings, and he had zigzagged his way home from the lobbies of different buildings, and ran home and said, "We have to flee." and the war started for us, and it was just a horrible experience. My parents, at the end of the war, weighed some 70 and 80 pounds, and normally they weighed twice as much. So it was just a terrible time of threats and deaths and fear and just great uncertainty.
Now, by the way, when I look at this, I look at this very closely, I look back and I see, you know, and I wasn't around in 1938. I came a little after that, but I look back and I see Germany. Germany in 1937-38, right before Hitler took over, was in the same place that this country, that the United States is in right now, that America is in. Economic horrible conditions. Also, one of the most important things that they lacked, that we are starting to lack here also, was identity. I'm quite confident if you go out in the street and ask 30 people what an American is, you're going to get 25 different definitions. And so what Hitler did, he promised them things. And when he promised them things, they began to feel accepted again, and they created this identity, whatever that was, and that's how he controlled it. Do you see this country in the same kind of condition pre-World War II that Germany was in those days?
Well, you know, a lot of people have asked me on these interviews, how would you compare your experience under the Nazis in Holland in World War II with what's happening in the world today? And I tell them the answer is it's the same thing. Hitler wanted to kill Jews and Christians and take over the world. And the fanatic Islamic jihadists want to do the same thing, kill Jews, Christians, and take over the world. It's the same spirit of death. It's just repeating itself, history repeating itself, really.
Sure, and look at what happened in Germany right around the time Hitler took over. The banks were nationalized. The schools were nationalized. It just goes on and on. We're starting to see the same thing. When I brought you in, obviously from your press release, looking at what's going on with the indoctrination of our children today, what they are learning as opposed to what they could be learning. And if you listen to a lot of these kids, most of it is social, most of it is political, and they have no idea what they're talking about, but they've been taught to say a thing. And because of that, this is what we may be looking at in the next 10, 15 years, a socialist country. We might be looking at socialist Europe as opposed to free America.
Absolutely. I remember reading a story not too long ago of a survey that was done among some high school students in a high school in California. And the question was asked to them, was Hitler a famous soccer coach or was he a dictator? And Michael, 40% of them said he was a soccer coach. So I hear repeatedly people say, young people need to read a book like this. I'm not saying it is because it's my book, but people need to read books like this because they don't know what happened really, and nor do they realize it could happen.
Seth,
I'm very concerned about...
Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead and repeat what you said. Well, you got cut off for about 30 seconds.
I'm sure. I remember reading a survey was done to some high school. They were asked, was Hitler a famous soccer coach or was he a dictator? And 40% of them said he was a soccer coach because in the public being taught what really happened in history in World War II, and they don't understand the dynamic of that. And how what changed the world, and so they are not prepared for the future because things like that could happen here in this country. When I was running for political office, I had a line in my speech, my stump speech, that said, "When little Holland was in trouble, big America was out. If America ever were to be in trouble, who would or could come and bail?" And the answer is nobody. Nobody like America. And it was just the benefit of American military bringing...
John, let me hold you up, if you can hear me or not. I want to end the interview right now, and I'd like to get you rescheduled in. What you have to say is extremely important, and you're cutting out, and I want to make sure this message gets heard. Seth, can you hear me? Say that to him.
Hello world, this is Nico, I woke up this morning with the sun on my face. Thought about the future of the world, a better place. No more fear, no more doubt, clarity in my lies. Let's jump by faith, fly. It's a new day for the world to see. There's a hope for you and me. It's a new day for the world to see. There's a hope for you and me. Have you ever seen a flower blooming in the spring? The laughter of a child, the innocence it brings. Have you ever had a lover whisper your name? There's a thousand reasons why we should hope and see. There's a hope for you and me. It's a new day for the world to see. There's a hope for you and me. If you feel like home is gone, lift up your eyes and know freedom in your heart. It's a new day for the world to see. There's a hope for you and me. It's a new day for the world to see. There's a hope for you and me. Yeah. It's a new day for the world to see. There's a hope for you. There's a hope for you, my friend. It's a new day for the world to see. Every child and every plan, every gift and every hand. There's a reason. It's a new day for the world to see. There's a hope for you, my friend. Every joy and every dream, every hope and everything. Every child and every friend, every gift and every hand, every joy and every dream, every hope and everything, every child and every friend, every gift and every hand, every joy and every dream, every hope and everything, every child and every friend, every gift and every hand, every song and every dream, every hope and everything.
Child and every friend. It's a new day. Different hat or pull a disappearing act on you.
I don't need your anger. I don't need your pain. I don't need your answer. So I'm not listening.
No. got a green light. Hey, baby, I'm good to go. I don't need your anger. I don't need your pain. I don't need your answer. So why not listen?
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love is burning.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time.
Steve Wolf with us. He's the author of The Secret Science Behind Movie Stunts and Special Effects. He is a highly experienced movie stunt and special effects coordinator. He uses science, listen to the word science, to meet the challenges of making movies thrilling. And on learning that U.S. students ranked 23rd in science knowledge, he was stunned that the nation had put a man on the moon but was now failing basic science, and that kids who can tell you every line from their favorite movie can't remember a thing of what they've learned in school. So he uses Hollywood's ability to capture and to hold the kids' attention, and he does it in a way of helping students master the science that they need in order to solve the future's problems. And let us say, Steve, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Michael. I enjoy being with you here.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. Steve, what's the magic? What is that certain something that will cause a kid or an adult or somebody to stay focused for a good amount of time on whatever the subject matter is, whether it's the movies, science, education, whatever? What is that something that will hold my interest?
You know, the magic is simply that you're interested. If you're interested, you can pay attention to anything for as long as you want to. If you're bored, you tune out very quickly.
So these kids
who were told are bored and they have no attention span, they're simply being presented to by teachers who don't know how to hold their interest. You put that same kid in front of his Xbox and, you know, 12 hours will go by and he won't blink an eye.
You know, by the way, I think a great example of that was Avatar. Half the time I had no idea what they were talking about, but it was so involved in the effects that it kept me through the entire movie.
Interesting. Well, I think that if we figure out what kids are interested in, and then we draw off of the science that make those things possible, we'll have kids' interest. And if they're interested in their video games or they're interested in movies, television shows, stunts, special effects, whatever their interest is, I'm sure it's all built with science. You know, it's scientists who build their video games, and scientists who build the movies that they enjoy watching, scientists who invent the foods that they enjoy eating. So you find out what a kid's interests are, and then you talk about the science that makes their subject matter fascinating to them. And my experience was that so many kids were interested in how movie stunts and special effects were done, I thought I'd use my own industry as a way to teach the kids about the physics and the chemistry and the optics and the mechanics that makes the stunt world possible.
You know, it's interesting. We talk about violence, 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 and we see it all over the place. But TV violence, in a way, it could be good if you could capture that same attention span that we spend on the violence and put it on something else.
Yeah, I've worked on movie sets for 23 years. I've never seen any violence on a movie set. I've seen science used to create the illusion of violence plenty of times. So when you show kids how that's done, they actually stop perceiving it as violence. They don't say, oh, that guy got shot, that was so cool. They see somebody have a squib blow out of their chest, and they say, oh, I know how they do that. They used an electric circuit, which started a chemical reaction to turn a solid into a gas, and it made pressure, and the pressure pushed the blood out of their chest. And then they're thinking like little scientists. they're no longer caught up in the silly drama of whatever the context of the film is, but they're thinking about the technology of how the film was created.
Yeah, Steve, you know what would be interesting, you know, and in your talking points, which I think is great, you know, you can learn all the science you need to know from six movie stunts. One of the stunts, an example of that. What is it that we learn from a stunt?
Well, something as simple as a person walking through a smoky room, or, you know, they come out on the dock and it's foggy outside. How we create smoke and fog for movies using a really simple machine called a smoke machine. You put liquid in, you turn the machine on, the electricity turns the electricity is turned into heat, and the heat heats up the liquid. And then what comes out of the front of the machine is smoke. So the smoke is really just liquid that's had more energy added to it to turn it into a gas. And so what that machine does is it just changes things among our three most common states of matter. It changes liquids into gases to create smoke. So very, very simple. And, you know, all kids need to know what the states of matter are to be successful in school and within any basic science.
Now, more and more schools are starting to bring you in, aren't they?
Yeah, we're doing about 200 schools a year right now, and I'm doing a tremendous amount of keynote speaking for science teachers, showing them how to make science interesting and relevant for their students. Because it's not just the students whose lives are affected, but really all of our lives are affected by our economy. And if we don't have sufficient number of scientists and engineers in our country, then those jobs will all move to countries where education is done better. So we really all have skin in the game here in getting our students more interested and more proficient in science.
Now, by the way, Steve, you know the kind of things that the kids are learning in school today, and they're very careful because they don't want to get hurt and they don't play dodgeball, and all of the things that used to be don't exist anymore. So there's got to be that certain spark, that something that value. We've got a dropout rate, Detroit, 55%. Major cities, it's 25, 30% dropout rate. And I would venture to guess the reason for the dropout rate is there's no value for staying in school for these kids. And when it comes down to it, it's the value for leaving is senior than the value for staying. So what I'm hearing you say, if you create it in such a way and there's value in learning, they're going to stay in school and they're going to get the most they possibly can out of it. But you've got to have that certain something to connect them to that learning possibility.
Yeah, our brains are already pre-wired to reward us for learning. We have that thing called the aha response, where your brain rewards you for acquiring new information by giving you a little dopamine treat. If kids are getting that regularly from their educational experiences, then the experience itself is rewarding. But if teachers are just focusing on trying to cram as much information into the kids as they can so that they can do well on standardized tests, then that aha factor never gets there.
So in essence, what you're really doing is you're going back to basics with this. No matter how far advanced the science is, it's back to basics. What's going to make me go aha? What's going to make me say, oh, I can do that to fix my life. I can do that to fix this. I can do that to become better, whatever the case is. So what I'm hearing you saying, you're triggering recognition within them to be able to go on and do whatever it is they thought they couldn't do.
Yeah, we all have a imagination, and we all have an ability to picture the world in a way in which it currently is not at this time. You know, my 6-year-old says, Dad, I want you to invent a time machine so I can go back and meet my great grandpa that I never met. You know, he has a vision. He expects me to go to Home Depot with him that afternoon and buy the parts to build this machine. And I haven't told him that I don't know how to do that yet, because I certainly don't want to give him the idea that it's not possible, simply because we don't know how to do it yet. And I hope that he'll keep that vision alive, and, you know, one day he'll make that machine. Or he'll build that other machine that he wants to do, that he can travel on Earth, land, sea, and outer space so that he can explore the world. We've only got the chair built so far. The rest of it is still coming along.
But
the idea is, you know, that the kids have an imagination. They want to invent things. They want to see things that don't exist yet. And science is the way that they're going to create these experiences for themselves.
Now, are you beginning to teach people this process? Because obviously when it really kicks in, you're not going to be able to do this by yourself. So are you teaching teachers?
Yes, I'm teaching the teachers how to make their lessons exciting and relevant for their students. And I'm hoping that people will reject the idea of teaching to the test, and they'll focus on teaching students to learn for the joy of learning and to learn for the benefit of understanding how the world works, so that they'll have the tools with which to manipulate the world to meet their needs. We're going to need energy in the future. We're going to need medicine in the future. We're going to need to solve problems that haven't yet presented. And kids need to be able to think like scientists. They need to understand the basic blueprints of how the universe works, and that they're going to have to be comfortable manipulating those tools so that they can invent the things they're going to need. And for me, it's really personal. I've got three boys, and I want them to be confident in the world. I want them to live in a world that knows how to solve problems, because kids are smart, not a world that's full of school dropouts who are, you know, failed by miserable educational systems.
Now, what I can see here also, too, you know, if you define science is provable. Something, you can take it apart and you can prove this is why it does what it does, and then you put it back together again. And if you look at education today, English, math, it's all science. And I would venture to guess that you can take the stunts, quote unquote, and let it weave into every phase and facet of education.
So from the moment a script is conceived, how it's written, how a story is put together, the vocabulary, the references, the history behind the story of how the story came to be. It's a very artificial construct in education that we have subjects. You know, we have English, we have math, we have science, we have social studies. In the real world, all of these subjects exist simultaneously in the pursuit of any study. There's nothing that you can study that doesn't have all these things in it. And it's very easy for administrators to break these things apart and make them subjects, but it's really not how the real world works. And we're seeing more of a movement towards a whole school approach to education, a more curriculum view.
So because when you really come down to it, you talk about the real world of education. Education, academics are fine in school, but the real learning comes when you get out of school. And if you go all the way back many, many years ago, 20, 30 years before you were here, they had wood shop, they had auto shop, they had metal shop, they had all of those things that would be skills that kids needed if they weren't going to have ongoing and continuous education, so they were prepared to get out there in the world. They're not prepared today. They're being socially engineered for whatever reason to learn certain things that are not going to do them any good once they get out. So I think what you've got here, you know, the method that you're using, what you've got here is a way back to go back to basics. Because if you talk science, you have to break it down. And if you break it down, it's very logical. There's kids today that if they're behind the counter in a market, that if you hand them $20, they have a hard time counting the money back to you. They don't have the computer. And that's really what I think we're starting to miss today, the ability to do critical thinking. The computer's taking it away.
You know, I think you're absolutely right there. Perhaps giving too much credit to critical thinking, basic thinking. I don't think that making change for a 20 is critical thinking. It's basic math, and kids can't do that.
No, and it's true.
Yeah, so they're really very much being failed by our education system, and our education system's not the only one. It's not a situation where we don't have other models that we can look to. There are at least 20 countries who perform better in tests of their ability to think critically and possess useful knowledge, and we're not doing a very good job at looking at how those countries go about educating kids. Part of it's cultural, of course. We're pretty easy on kids in this country, and we don't push kids the way, let's say, they might in Korea, where the culture allows parents to, buckle down on those kids and say, you get home, you're going to do 4 hours of homework, and, you're going to end up knowing your content. And there's trade-offs for that, too, because, we want kids to be kids also. We want them to enjoy the ability to play and to develop creative skills and social skills. And I think kids who are pushed strictly academically, you know, don't necessarily turn out so well either. They might be able to get a high-paying job as a software engineer, but that isn't necessarily creating a happy life for them. In Japan, we're seeing kids who are, you know, very successful academically that are utterly miserable in their jobs.
Yeah.
So we've got to find a trade-off, but I think that the best trade-off is somebody who's creative and smart and capable. They can envision new things. They have the social skills to recruit other people to work on projects with them, and they have a sense of optimism of knowing that if they put together the right team of smart people, that they're going to be able to solve whatever problems they put their minds to. And that's the type of personality that is successful in business now. You know, it's an entrepreneurial model where you say, okay, I believe that if we get smart people and we focus on a problem, we can solve it. And that model leads to businesses that make billions of dollars. The richest people in industry now are practicing business forms, that didn't exist 20 years ago. If you told somebody, 20 years ago that you're going to be an internet marketer, they'd look at you like you're crazy.
No, absolutely. And, by the way, it is very interesting because what we can forecast today, it's unbelievable what we have in front of us. And there's so many of us that can't even get a picture of what the possibility of the world could be like. Steve, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you, find what you're doing, follow you, blogs, and also buy the book?
Absolutely. You go to Science in the Movies. You can get my book there. It's called The Secret Science Behind Movie Stunts and Special Effects. It's targeted at 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th grade readers who want to know behind the scenes what happens on movie sets. And in the course of reading their book, they're going to end up knowing all of the physical science that they need to be successful in their elementary and middle school careers. So that's scienceinthemovies.com is the website. You can get a hold of me there for presentations in schools and also pick up a copy of the book, which I know the kids will absolutely go crazy over.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I think it's a great idea. It's very innovative. I haven't really talked to anybody who's even thought about doing something like this. So anyway, not good luck to you. Good skill to you. Go get them.
Thank you, Michael. I sure appreciate being on the air with you this evening.
Take care. Good night.
Thank you. Good night, Michael.
Some of these days you'll feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging, you miss my kissing, you may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so quick, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days my hugging, you're gonna miss my kissing, you may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
If you need me, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're missing your brown-eyed daddy. Grab it now, some of these days.
Charlie Massimo with us. He is the president of CJM Physical Management, which provides comprehensive wealth management service to individuals and corporations. He specializes in comprehensive wealth management services to ultra affluent families, families with autistic children, and closely held businesses. Graduate of Manhattanville College, his achievements include being named to the 2008 Reuters Top Advisors list and nominated to Worth's Magazine Top 100 Wealth Advisor. Charlie, hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we really come down to it, you know, I know you're a published author and you're an industry expert. You're recognized, and you have been for many, many years now. And one of the biggest problems that we come up against today, and we hear so much information about it, it's the economy. The economy has always been cyclical. It's got its ups, it's got its downs, but it always kind of comes back at you. But it's scary to even forecast today. So when somebody's got money to be able to invest for the future, to go out there and do it yourself has got to be absolutely insane today. You need somebody like yourself that would be, quote unquote, hold my hand, take me through it, and show me what there is. Because a lot of the information we hear just isn't so. Charlie, what's that magic? How do we get through some of these hard times to realize that what we'll have in 10 years from now should be able to satisfy the demands it takes to live?
Yeah, exactly. You almost said the word magic. I'm not so sure there's any kind of magic when it comes to investing. But, you know, as an investor, I mean, there's always a reason to be nervous about investing in the markets, whether it's the economy, unemployment. There's always a number of reasons. So what we try to help coach people to do is really control those things that are within your control versus trying to focus on the things that are out of your control, such as the direction of the market. And as long as you always take a long-term perspective and you focus on three or four real core areas of investing, you'll have a much more successful experience versus trying to listen to the so-called experts on, even though I've been on programs like CNBC, it's a lot of talking heads that go on, and
sure,
a lot of the advice they provide is usually misguided advice.
Yeah, no, by the way, there's an interesting thing also, and we've got to be able to back off. And I'm going to, sometimes the word greed is a good thing. If you're in business, that's going to, you know, that's going to give you the impetus to go ahead and do the best you can possibly do. But the other side of that is greed. It scares people, and it gets people in positions where if they think they're going to get something and they're going to get it fast, they're going to jump in and they're going to do it. I spent 11 years as an accounting and tax practitioner years ago, and I would watch people come in and they would go to the internet, they would do investments on the internet, and 1 week they'd make $10,000, $15,000, $25,000, and then the next week they'd lose $30,000, and then they come back and make some at the end of the year. All of this money that they made, it was taxable, and they didn't think about that, and they got themselves in trouble. So my contention is if you're going to get into something, make sure of what you're going to get into, but know what the consequences are before you take the step.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Michael. You know, a lot of times people venture into avenues, whether it's, you know, exotic products like commodities or certain closed-end funds. If you really don't understand whether it's the investment itself or the consequence of the investment, you probably should steer real far away from it and try to keep it really as simple as possible. And you know, again, there are so many simple ways to be successful at investing, but people think they have to be great stock pickers. They think it needs to be real sexy to be successful, and the opposite is real true. You know, investing should be real boring. And the more boring your investments are, the more successful over long periods of time you'll be.
Sure. By the way, one of the things you bring up, and I think it's so spot on, and I've yet to hear anybody in the business of finance say it this way, it's your behavior. Your investments actually are who you are and how you respond to your life. And if you start to get that, all of a sudden things can happen. If you're, you know, if you're a go-getter and you're out there, that's how your investments are going to be. And if you're, like you just said, if it's boring, you know, you sit back and you watch it grow and you let it happen. But to know yourself also and to tie it to that form of investment might be the quote-unquote, let's use the word, the magic to keep you safe.
I agree. You know, we have a mantra at our firm, and it's the dominant determinant of long-term real-life investment returns is the behavior of the investor himself.
Yeah.
You know, it has very little to do with the mutual fund you pick or the money manager you pick. It all has to do with how you're going to behave and how well can you control your emotions when things get real rocky, as they have been the past few years, and how disciplined can you be as an investor? Because if you don't have a discipline and if you don't have a process, nobody will know what the outcome may be, and that outcome may be something you'll never be able to recover from. So again, it's your ability to kind of control the emotion, and that's really a determinant on how successful you'll be, instead of trying to chase the winners or chase the hot stock or chase the hot mutual fund.
Sure, Charlie, let me put that in a different way, and absolutely right on with that. Let's say I'm one of those hot. I see it right now. Let me go get it. Okay, what stops me from getting in trouble? I pick up the phone. This is where you have to get yourself in the pattern of doing so. You bite your tongue. You pick up the phone and say, Charlie, it's a this, this, and that, and I really want to do it, but what's going to happen if I do or don't do it? That's the safety net, and I think that's really what it is. If I know my behavior, and yet if I have somebody neutrally looking at that behavior, looking over my shoulder, seeing what I don't see, bringing that invisible up to the table, quote unquote, then all of a sudden there's a safety factor in there that I didn't have before, and most people don't. So if you know your behavior and you got somebody you can trust to work with, if you're a hot shot, get in there and find out from that person you're working with. Or if you're too slow, you pick up the phone slowly and you get stimulated. You know, it's that balance.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, you said something earlier on about, you know, people try to do it themselves, and there's a lot of real smart people out there in this world that could probably do it themselves, but again, they just don't have that ability to know who they are as an investor. And you know, a lot of times we're really more behavioral psychologists than we are financial advisors, because we really need to hold the hands of our clients, and we need to, you know, tell them what's in their best interest instead of telling them what they want to hear. And no, that's a big difference.
No question about it. Because when you really come down to it, if you have a basic understanding of human nature and what's going to cause somebody, what's going to spark that call to action or slow somebody down, they don't have to know it. And the reason I say that is everybody has their expertise in different areas. A good leader knows when to follow. A good teacher knows when to be a student. It's just knowing when to do it. I wished I could sit here and say I knew everything about everything, but my goodness, Charlie, I don't. But what I have is the magic. I've got the Rolodex.
And that in itself means a lot. And again, you know, I always try to bring it back to this point. And investing really is so easy. It's just not it's real simple. It's just not easy because of all the noise we hear around us. And we just don't have the ability to turn off that noise. And that's a problem, because in this day and age with technology, the noise is coming at us instantaneously. And if we choose to focus on that noise, It really kind of inhibits us from doing the things that we should do to be real successful, because we just panic. We just become so fearful.
And especially in today, you know, rebalancing your portfolio, very important, because what it was 2, 3, 4 years ago is not what it is today. The things that were solid and would bring you a decent return today are not what they were yesterday and back and forth. So it's realistically having somebody that's keeping tabs on that market, knowing exactly what's going on. Is real estate going to be good anymore? Is real estate good today? Or should we go out and invest in hopscotch? You know, whatever the case may be, you got to have somebody like yourself who is constantly at it all day long, because somebody else is not going to know.
Yeah, and you know, investing is a full-time job, and if you treat it as a part-time job, that's the kind of results you're going to get, you know, part-time results. And unfortunately, most people don't experience the type of returns they should get in the market or the market allows them, because, again, you know, our brains are really not programmed to be successful investors, because the things to be successful are actually counterintuitive to most. To your point about rebalancing, you know, for instance, everybody wants to chase, again, whether it's the hot stock or the hot mutual fund, and they'll go into that mutual fund, whether it's, you know, U.S. large cap stocks like a GE or a Home Depot. They'll all go into it after it's experienced the 30% kind of a growth of return, when really the real time to go into it is when it's at a low, because that's the greatest opportunity for huge gains in the market. And for instance, this year, to your rebalancing point, because international markets sold off last year, we're actually rebalancing our portfolios back into the international stocks, the ones that have performed the poorest. And most people, what they're going to do is they're going to sell off those kind of asset classes or those parts of their portfolio, because they don't want to be in an asset class or a stock that's kind of been dead for a year or two, not realizing that this is actually the greatest opportunity for return. So we're actually rebalancing into those parts of the portfolio that have performed the worst, thereby giving us the opportunity for the greatest gain.
And most of the time, you have to know what your purpose is for the investment, i.e., why do I want to invest? So let's say my answer to you would be a retirement income. I want to make sure that I have enough money to live on. So let's say, pick a number, I make 10 grand a month right now, and it takes me $8,000 to live. All right, I got a couple of grand left over, so I'm okay. I can do what I want to do. But what if I project ahead 10 years from now? Well, you know, what's that $10,000 going to be worth? That $8,000 I have to spend on my living expenses today may be $15,000. And if I'm only bringing 10 in and I got a negative 5, I'm in trouble.
Yeah, that's a great point, Michael. And that's what we try to, again, counsel our clients on. Because a lot of people, what they do, the closer they get to retirement, they'll kind of hunker down. They'll get a lot more conservative. And that's kind of sometimes a real big mistake. Because, again, to your point, if you need $10,000 a month today, and just by pure inflation, in 10 years, you're going to need $15,000 to produce or to be able to purchase the same kind of things that the $10,000 did today. And if you're building a portfolio that all of a sudden stunts your growth, so you're not able to produce that $15,000 eventually in the future, you're exchanging one risk for another, and that risk potentially is running out of money.
Sure.
So again, as an investor, you need to always keep that long-term perspective and that long-term look. Because none of us know how much longer we're going to live. So if we plan as if we're going to live another 40 or 50 years, and we happen to, you know, die sooner, fine, we've planned. But if we only plan to live another 10 years and we live 20, well, we have a problem.
No, absolutely. I'll give you a prime example of what I was just talking about. When I was a kid, now this we won't talk about, but this is our secret, all right? When I was a kid, it was 25 cents to get into the show. If you smoked in those days, it was 18 cents a pack. Gas was 18 to 20 cents. If you wanted to buy a soda, it was 7 cents with a 2-cent deposit on the bottle. My mom bought a house for $10,000, and our payments were $50 a month. Where are you going to live on that today?
Exactly. And to bring it to that point, I'm a big New York Giant fan, and here in the East Coast, you know, Giants are in the playoffs this weekend, and I just had a pay for my playoff tickets that were about $150 a ticket for upper deck. When I first started going to Giant games in the early 70s, The tickets were literally $2.50.
Yeah.
So again, to your point, nothing stands still. And I think when people get into retirement, they think their expenses are going to go down, when actually in retirement, your expenses continue to go up because you use more of the stuff that goes up more and more, such as gasoline, such as milk, such as eggs. So people, I think, underestimate truly what it costs to retire.
In 1961, I worked for a place called Norris Thermidor Corporation in Southern California, and I was making, are you ready for this? I'm going to impress you here. $1.65 an hour. Big money in those days. Okay, but that's the point. That's really the point. Look at what things cost today. What's it going to cost in 5 years from now? We have no idea.
Yeah, right, exactly. So why not overestimate? And again, but you need to have a plan. You can't just say, all right, wake up one morning and say, today I'm going to retire and be able to do it. It just doesn't work that way. It takes a lot of preparation. It takes a lot of estimating. And you really have to manage your expectations. And that's what we have to do a lot with our clients, manage their expectations and tell them, hey, you know, your cost of living, you don't have the assets, you don't have the portfolio to be able to keep up with your cost of living. So we have to make some adjustments. And you have to be realistic in what you're trying to achieve based on what you have.
Charlie, let me ask you this. We're starting to run out of time. Your website is www.cjmfiscal.com. I go to the website. What do I find?
You go to our website, we have a number of free resources, a number of free white papers on topical issues such as inflation and how to plan for inflation, such as retirement, such as different investment strategies for different people. So we're big believers in educating first and then providing services after. So if you go to our website, in addition, there's a blog site there, which we blog twice a week on topical issues, and hopefully people will find it very resourceful.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And the stuff about the 18 cents a pack and gas, we won't talk about that.
Yeah, promise. Just between the two of us, Michael.
I got it. Hey, Charlie, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Bye now.
Faithful and true, and cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes. Young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
And to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do.
Kristen Ann with us. She's the author of Exploring Sacred Space, a vast quest, a very vast quest. Kristen spent more than a lifetime studying spirituality and metaphysics. Her life's been one of very unusual experiences, encounters, and constant coincidences that have added to her studies, deepening her understanding of life at its core levels. She had a near-death experience as a child, which instilled a sense of knowing that there are many more levels of existence than the physical one that we see. And so she began her lifelong quest as a child, reading any spiritual and metaphysical books she could find, starting in the mid-60s. And in the mid-70s, she studied the research and findings of the profound clairvoyant Rudolf Steiner. And her two-year studies of Steiner were greatly enhanced by having Professor Werner Gloss, who has also provided a level of clairvoyance. And let us say, Kristen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Kristen, we see a lot of life. You walk out in the morning, you take a look at what's out there, but most of us really don't see. We don't experience everything that there is because we're so busy all the time. How do you break through that? How do you break through that busyness and see what's really there that's in front of your eyes, but most of the time is invisible?
Right. It's definitely an art form, you know, to step back and see a little bit more. There are so many more deeper levels to life than we usually see. Some people, myself included, meditate as often as we can, like for 20 minutes, half hour every morning if we can. And this really seems to open your awareness to things, to sharpen your awareness.
You know, we live in a kind of an interesting world now. I go all the way back. Oh, I was brought up in the 50s. And being brought up in the 50s as a teenager, for the most part, it was a different feeling. I'm going to say it was a different consciousness. Everything felt different. The vibration was different. It was one of those kind of places where you didn't have to lock the door when you walked out.
Right.
There wasn't sense of. But then we bring it fast forward to today. There's a completely different feeling moving through. I'm going to say this planet, not just the country. And
right,
it seems
right,
like
right.
It's stimulated by fear.
Yes, very much. It's hard to exactly pinpoint what happened, but I explain in my book, which you can see that at exploringsacredspace.com, I explain how the energy is very much changed now on the whole planet. And from my studies of clairvoyant Rudolf Steiner and with a clairvoyant professor, we learned that there is a big transition going to happen in our lifetimes. And in order for this to happen in the best way possible, energy, it was explained to us, and this just blew our minds, it was explained that energy needs to be streamed toward Earth from the mid-last century onward. Energy would be increasing and increasing. Things would be changing and getting faster and faster as we neared the beginning of the 21st century and beyond. And we can see that happening. I mean, all the things that I learned, I can see happening and taking place.
You know, there's an interesting word that we really have to take a look at. And that word, and I know you deal with it constantly, that word is transition. Most people are frightened to death of transition. Transition is as simple as you're single, you get married, now you're transitioning into another way of living your life. Most people are frightened to death of what they don't know. How do we transition into this with the ability to be able to deal with it when it comes?
Right. Well, the reason I wrote this book is to, there's been so much negative speculation out there about the transition and 2012. I wrote the book to share a more factual view of what will be happening, and it's nothing to be frightened of, but the book is very important because there are elements in there that teaches you how to prepare. The transition is something that actually has happened roughly every 13,000 years on this planet throughout history. And I show a diagram of that. You can find it on the website, exploringsacredspaces.com, if you click on the chapters and chapter 2. But this transition will be different from all others in the past. It's going to be a very uplifting one. And I explain in the book why it's different.
Let me just add something to this, which I think is very interesting. And this has nothing to do with political left, right, and different, like this one, don't like that one. That's not where I'm at with this. But the December 21st, the 2012, is a month after the presidential election right here in this country. And it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. Yes. Interesting timing on this thing.
Right, it is. You know, what I found so interesting about that date, and my professor never mentioned that date. When we would ask him when things are going to happen, he would always say, no one knows the exact date or time, and that phrase is actually said in the Bible. But it's interesting that in addition to the Mayans saying that time will no longer continue the same, and I note here that they never said time would end. They only said that time will no longer continue the same. But scientists also have stated factually that there is a major alignment happening on that very date. And they know there will be some effects on Earth, but they don't know what it is. So it's my understanding that this transition will be a refinement into a different level of being.
Okay, now when we talk about a different level of being, is that physical? Is that emotional, mental? Is that a way, or are we going to think differently and view the world differently, which would cause us to act differently? Or are we physically going to go through some kind of a transformation that that will set that base for everything else that's going to happen? Are we going to look different?
Well, here's where no one really can tell you the exact scenario. But the difference between my book and anything else that's been written is I've given the clearest information on this that no one else has been able to give to date. But no one knows exactly what it's going to be like, except that from everything I've learned, as science fiction, you know, as wildly sci-fi as this sounds, we are going to be transitioning both through time, and this would explain the Mayans' way of saying that time will no longer be counted the same. We are going to be transitioning into the future, and several different credible sources have said this, as well as into a finer state of being where our bodies will not be quite so physical. But it will be a very uplifted and happy state.
Now, this brings up an interesting
nothing to
point.
Be afraid of.
Okay, but this brings up an interesting point. You know, when you say nothing to be afraid of, for people who have the ability to see beyond and look through, okay, viable statement. But for those people who don't know, it's got to be absolutely frightening. And from what I'm hearing you say, that you better prepare for it. Because if you are not emotionally ready, not physically ready, not intellectually ready, if you're not emotionally ready, spiritually ready, you could not make that transition.
No, it's not that fearful. Basically, anyone, and that is why the energy has been raised so much, as I understand it, so that there is, you know, all these new age movements and new awakenings and understandings and new levels of sharing. Basically, everyone who is a good person will be making this transition. You don't have to worry that you're not in the right emotional place. It's only those who are very negative, who have more evilness in them who will not be. As I understand it, and here is another element that will sound very sci-fi and hard to understand, but there will be actually a split in realities. Those whose energy is not quite ready to make this transition, to continue their growth on a different place, in a different place, a new earth, if you'd like to call it that, there will be a different reality for them to continue on in the more physical dimension.
Okay, but still, if you're not prepared for that, what can happen? If somebody is literally not prepared for that to occur, they're not going to make it.
No, I would not say that. I would not understand it that way. I think that anyone who is a basically good person is going to make it.
Okay, but what is it basically? What is a basically good person? If I go to the Middle East, and by the way, I'm on your side of the table with this, so don't hear that I'm trying to block it in any way, because I'm with it 100%, maybe 200%. But you take somebody in the Middle East, it all has to do with something called ethics. Ethics is not, ethics is balancing how you are on the inside and acting like that on the outside. If you're a killer on the inside and you kill on the outside, you're
right.
Being ethical in your world. All right. So if we go to, let's say, Middle East, and when they torture and they kill people and they do whatever they do, is this evil? Is this saying that a particular mindset, a particular culture is going to die out because they're not going to be able to match up to this mindset? That's the question.
Right. As I understand it, that element that still harbors a lot of vengeance and negativity will have the opportunity to grow still continue on in this more physical level as we know it. They are not, as I, you know, interpret it, they would not be ready to make it to the next level.
Okay.
With the rest of us.
Yeah, because
and yet they will be given every opportunity to continue to grow to the point where one day they will make it to the next level.
Okay, but if I think that I'm living life the right way, if I think that prime example, in some cultures and in some religions, if your daughter is not doing what you want your daughter to do, or your wife, you can take her on the back and shoot her, and you're fine. It's within the law. Now, in that particular religion, that's a right thing to do. My world, it isn't. But at the same time, I'm not in that world. So how do you tell someone that they're not, they don't have the right consciousness, or they're not doing the right thing? They've lived all of their life believing in a certain way, following the path of what they would consider the God and spirituality. Now, all of a sudden, they find out that it might not have been the right thing to do.
Right, right. You know, each different civilization sort of lives within, if you'd like to call it, a group soul, you know, a way of being. And who's to say? But I would think that in those cases, there is still a lot more growing, a lot more awakening to do. And, you know, I'm not one to say or to pass judgment, but they may need to grow more in the physical dimension first before making that transition.
Sure. But I don't think that there's judgment in the question. The question is,
right,
truly right? You know, what is truly that?
If you truly think it's right, yeah. It's a hard one to say. It's, yeah.
Sure. And there's all those variables to come into play, but from what I'm hearing you say, the interesting thing that will happen with the transition, the judgments, and there will be judgments, if you're one of the bad guys, whatever that means, and you're not going to get there, then there is a judgment, and the judgments will be beyond what we as human beings have set as staples, as rules to live by. And it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. I'm going to be here. I'll make it. And as a matter of fact, on the 22nd of December, you should be back on the show, and we'll talk about what happened.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah, I really believe that. We're starting to, we've got about a minute or two to run out of time. So I pick up the book, and I read it page by page, cover to cover. What's my takeaway? Kristen, what do I get that I didn't have before I read this book?
You will have more of an understanding of our point in time and why it is that we are transitioning and why this is necessary, and also the other beings who are playing a part of this, in this, the masters and the hierarchy who have been living incognito among us, and how they are helping us, how they are helping this whole thing to take place. It's all a fascinating concept.
When you talk
one
concept,
that you really have to read.
Yeah, I know. But when you talk concept, though, when you realistically talk concept, you've got to be able to believe this. You've got to be able to prepare yourself for it. And my feeling is this: if nothing happened, you still got a year to go. And within that year, why can't you promote being the very best you can be? And if it doesn't happen, look what you've gained, look what you've garnered in your life.
Right, right. And the book states that, you know, I'm not saying that it is going to happen on this date, but it just could, you know. In fact, someone named Drunvalo is saying 2016. We don't know, but what we do know is there will be a transition in our lifetimes in the not-too-distant future.
Well, there would have to be, based on what's going on today. And one of the reasons I would say that there would have to be there is such confusion going on. There's confusion in the world. There's confusion in this country. I bet if I walk down the street in any given major city in this country today, and I said, what is an American, you would probably get a very much different definitions and so on and so forth. There was a time we knew who we were. That's getting lost, so something's got to happen. And with that, Kristen, we're starting to run out of time. One more time, please, with your website.
The website is exploringsacredspace.com.
Okay, can we buy the book?
And you can see the whole list of chapters, and you can even click on them to see the illustrations and to read an article about the book.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for being here. I'm serious. We have a date, the December 22nd of this year.
Wonderful. Great. Well, Happy New Year.
Oh, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
Carlin Montes de Oca is with us. She's an acupuncturist, a nutritional consultant, and Healthy for Life coach. She's in practice in Marin County, California, and the owner of Modern Alchemy Acupuncture and Nutritional Counseling. We're going to talk about something that everybody is concerned about, and there's not anybody that doesn't go through this that's living on this planet or beyond, something called anti-aging. We all do it, and let's say, Carlin, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael Ray. How are you doing?
Oh, I am good, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we really come down to it, everybody hears all of these myths about age. You know, you hit a certain age, you might as well give it up, and it's over with, etc. But you don't think that, do you?
Absolutely not. I'd like to, that is actually my favorite aging myth to bust, and this is why. Everybody does think it's downhill after a certain age, whether it's 50, 40, or you know, or beyond. But for myself, you know, I'm 50, and I actually feel better at 50 than I did at 40. And I really would love it, and I also talk about this all the time in my practice, that people really understand that maybe we are increasing in these years, but it doesn't mean that you have to enjoy your life any less, or that you won't be more attractive, or that your worth goes down. I think, in fact, it could be completely the opposite.
Oh, no question
about
it.
Probably, you know.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to
say. I was just going to say that, you know, as we get older, life can be extremely liberating. You know, we grow out of a lot of those hang-ups that we used to have when we were younger. And, in fact, they're showing us in studies that the older that we get, a lot of us are getting happier. So it's really about lifestyle and living well.
Well, isn't it a mindset also? I mean, realistically, if you think you're old and it's going to happen to you. But if you don't think you're old, you know, your body sets up this entire mechanism to get you to feel younger, feel better, et cetera. And I really believe after everything I've seen, after all these hundreds of years I've been on the planet, that it is really how you think about yourself is how you can end up looking.
Well, first of all, if you're hundreds of years old, as you say, you should be talking about, you should be on my side, and I should be interviewing you because you look marvelous. But it's absolutely true. I was just going to say, it's absolutely true. It's whatever your brain, wherever your mind goes, is where your body goes. So if that's the kind of mindset that you have, of course you will age. You'll age fast, you'll age quickly.
Yeah, but let me ask you a question. In the culture, we've been taught that you hit a certain age, this is what you do. You become 50 years old, all of a sudden ARP is sending you things, and at 55 this happens, and at 65 you go on Medicare. And I watch people constantly go into the marketplace. There are people 55 years old that can barely get down the aisle, and they look like they're 110 years old. And it seems as though it's almost a way of life in a way they've chosen, because there's so many people who do not get attention. So how do you get it? Well, I'm going to get sick and I'm going to get old and you're going to have to pay attention to me.
Well, yeah, that's a very interesting point. And that is pretty, I think that is very true. A lot of people do it for many reasons. There's a reason we hang on to age or illness or whatever it is. But one of the things that's happening right now is that we are seeing this chronic illness kind of pattern with people, and statistics are showing us that we're going to be coming down with these illnesses like arthritis and dementia and, diabetes is a big one that's coming down, heart disease. And that's why you see so many people aging so rapidly. And then the other mindset is, well, that's what happened to my parents, so that's what's going to happen to me. And that's what's happening to the people around me, so that's what's going to happen to me. But the truth is that's another big myth that we've all bought into. It does not have to be that way. And statistics show us, and life shows us, that we can alter those things. We can take steps to prevent it, even reverse a lot of the chronic illness that's out there.
And one of the things that you talk about that I think is so critical is to step out of your comfort zone. Too many people are frightened to death of the quote-unquote unknown, whatever the unknown is, and it's going to change from person to person to person. And there's that old adage, and I've probably said it 1,000 times, it's, you know, better unhappy than unsure. And there's too many people that have that attitude, and they stay stuck, and they die young.
That's true. I think stepping out of your comfort zone is one of the most important and most powerful steps that you can take every single day. And I know even the thought of it sounds scary to people. But the comfort zone can be something huge. Yeah, some people choose to jump out of planes or do whatever they want. But the comfort zone could be as small as just taking one single step towards something different that you would not necessarily do that day. Whether it's going to talk to somebody that, gosh, I've always wanted to talk to that person, but now I'm too shy. But just taking that step out, or maybe going a different, even just the simplest thing of going a different route on your way to work, things start changing as you start stepping out of your comfort zone. Since things start changing just in the synapses and the way that your brain works. And actually, it starts making kind of new connections and in some ways making you start to be young again, making to start new connections. Because as we know, the brain is one of the things that starts to go in time. But you need to be making those constant changes, those little changes of connection in order to keep that going and keep it healthy.
Oh, by the way,
stepping out of your comfort zone is critical. Yeah?
Yeah. No, I just saw something in your press release that is going to make us best friends. Ask me what I have. Ask me what I have in this house. Ask me. Go ahead.
All right. Michael Ray, what do you have in that house?
Funny you should ask that. How about there's 4 cats and 3 dogs running around here?
Yay! Now we are best friends. Because at my house, it's the opposite. There's 3 dogs here and 2 cats running around.
No, I got that loud and clear. That's what I saw. I said, okay, we're going to become best friends. Now, I really believe effectively, if you have animals, it's going to tell you what kind of a person you truly, really are, because they're going to reflect your personality and everything else. But I'd venture to guess one thing, and then we'll get back to staying young. The cats rule the house.
Right. I heard something that said cats rule, dogs serve. I thought that was very funny.
And you can always tell who owns what. If you go into the market, I'll make this quick, and it's inevitable. You're standing there, and the dog food's on one side, the cat food's on the other. The people who have dogs are throwing cans of food into the shopping cart, but the cat owners are philosophical. They sit and they think it out, and you can see them very quietly thinking of what to get next. Will they eat that tomorrow? Yeah, we know about this stuff.
Right. Yeah, so you've just brought up a very good point about, like, you know, because you and I have dogs and cats, and balance is so important for health. You know, we're doing well.
Absolutely, no question about it. Now, when we talk about health, now not diet. I think that the word diet should get thrown out the window. It's nutrition. Nutrition is critically important to your health, to your brain function, to your immune system, and to your general attitude of how you live your life.
Absolutely. In fact, I always laugh because the word diet, what are the first 3 letters of the word diet?
Die.
Die, exactly.
Yeah. Bye-bye,
so,
gone.
You know, so Yeah, exactly. So I agree with you. I wish there was even an even better word than nutrition, but I don't know what it is. Somebody will have to make it up one day. But it is an essential and critical part, obviously, of health. And there are so many. And the reason I don't like the word diet is because there's so many, like there's this diet and that diet and this and that. And so much of it is common sense. So much of it is common sense. But it is critical, and it is something that it's very important. And the one diet, which I think is funny, that most people are on, and you know, it does reflect the first three letters, is the standard American diet, which most people are on, which is this diet of excessive carbohydrates. And it would be one thing if they were healthy carbohydrates, but they're usually sugary things, the pastries, the donuts, the chips, those kind of things that we seem to be eating and consuming more kind of as a culture, as a society. And unfortunately, it's leading to a lot of illness and disease down the road.
By the way, I'm careful about most of what I eat, unless I want to gain some weight and then I'll stuff myself with everything. But the point of contention is this, and what I've learned about food over the years, your brain and your body is nothing more than a big electrochemical factory. And as an acupuncturist, as a practicing acupuncturist, you're dealing with the flow of energy. That's what we're dealing with, isn't it? It's a disconnect, and what you do is you reconnect. Am I close?
You know, yes, basically it is. We are dealing with energy. We're dealing with the word qi, and the closest interpretation of qi is energy. And it's usually that we're dealing with blockages. So, yeah, it's a disconnect that occurs, and when those blockages happen in people, which they happen probably as soon as you're born, things start to happen because life happens. And what we try to do is we interpret what's going on with the body, what signs and symptoms people are coming in with, and then we see where the blockages are, where there's stagnation, where things aren't moving, where things are moving too much, and we try to balance that out.
Okay, now let me tie food into that. When you eat something, whatever you eat, that food turns into chemicals, and those chemicals turn into energy. And based on what
you eat
is going to cause that energy to go where it's supposed to go or not, to make sure that part of your body, your anatomy, functions. So in essence, food is critically important to the function of your body, obviously, and to live. So when you're dealing with nutrition, it's the foods that will cause you to feel the best, to do the job, to move to the areas they need to move to end up allowing you to live a decent life. So food is not just food. Food has a purpose behind it. And the kind of food you eat is either going to build you up or knock you down. It's either going to disconnect you or connect you.
That's right. In fact, one of the things I always say, for example, people come in and, you know, I do this combination of acupuncture and nutritional counseling. And sometimes people are asking, well, why do you do both? And it's that, you know, I need to give people something to go home with that they can do in the rest of their life. I'm not their acupuncturist 24/7. You know, I don't go home with them. So they need to take control and do things for themselves. And, for example, people will come in and they've just broken a limb or, you know, they haven't just broken a limb, but they're recovering from that or they have some kind of condition, you know, an impaired shoulder, something going on. And I tell them, okay, well, these are the things that you can eat or that would be more helpful to get that, to get that better, and these are the things that I would suggest you stay away from. And the first thing is, I don't understand why I can't eat sugar. And I always say to them, okay, think of what sugar becomes in your body. Think of what it will turn into. So either you can eat, I'm just making it up, but let's say broccoli or a Snickers bar. The broccoli is probably going to be more helpful to get the tendons, the ligaments, everything, you know, repaired with the nutrients that it needs, more so than the Snicker bar, which is going to create more inflammation. So, you know, that's an example of what you're talking about, I think.
By the way, and inflammation is an extremely important word. Heart disease, most of what goes on in our bodies is caused from, quote-unquote, inflammation. And it's triggered by food and so on and so forth. One of the things that I've done, and I'm not a nutritionist, and I'm not a clinician, just over the years, certain things. If I get to a point where I really want something sugary and craving, I'll eat it. You know, I won't deprive myself. But that night before I go to bed, I will take some L-lysine and I will amp up with vitamin C to work against the effects of the sugar.
Yeah, I think that's a smart move, especially right now when it's the prime time that everybody's coming in complaining of flus and colds and all sorts of things going on with their immune system, and it's the time that everybody's eating, let's say, sweets and sugars and excess carbohydrates. It's, you know, the holidays, right? So sure. This is the best time that to have the strategy that you're talking about, or at least once you've done that, the next day, you know, the other thing is start drinking some water, start drinking lots of water, yeah. Try to detox the body. So, you know, you have your herbal teas, your things that are going to, you know, start cleaning out the toxins that you just put in. So it's good to have a strategy like the one that you just mentioned in place.
You know, by the way, I just noticed something. I didn't pronounce your first name right. Is it Carolyn or Carlin?
It's actually Carlene.
Oh, Carlene. Okay, I was close. Better yet. Okay.
You were close. I don't know that I noticed, but you were close.
Oh, okay. No, I used the K sound in it, so I'm good to go. Okay.
All right. You're now, good. You're good. We're still good friends.
Oh, good. I've still got the dogs. We're good.
Yeah, you got the dogs and the cats, so.
Yeah, I got three dogs that are—they're average out at about 100 pounds, but they think they're each one of them, and they think they're lap dogs. You know what that's like. Okay, now we got about a minute or so to go. Now I know you got all of this coming out in a book, The Secrets of Longevity. When is the book going to be released?
Well, actually, The Secrets of Longevity is a blog that I work on that I would really highly recommend people to go to, because that is something that it's a lot of really great free information. The book is another book that is to do with how animals help us heal, animals transforming the world one human at a time.
Hmm. Yeah, I'll give them transformation. I can say that. Okay.
Right. And now, that book will probably be out towards the end of this year.
Wonderful. Okay, now, where do we find you, website and plus the blog site?
Yes, absolutely. My website is called Modern Alchemy Acupuncture. Modern as M-O-D-E-R-N, Alchemy, A-L-C-H-E-M-Y, Acupuncture, acupuncture.com. That is a website that has everything you could possibly want on it. There's the blog Secrets of Longevity, which is a free blog and a really, I think, a very useful blog, especially for all of us looking for longer ways and healthier ways to live. There's also a free newsletter with a lot of great information that comes out, so I'd suggest signing up for that. There's even a free ebook, which is called How to Thrive in the Modern World. So lots of really great free resources. There's information on supplements and nutrition and acupuncture and all sorts of stuff that will really make 2012 a great year for your health if that's what you choose.
I have a great suggestion for you. Your web guy, tell him to get another name for the website and call it Carlin D.O. And everybody who logs onto that automatically goes to the other one if they can't remember acupuncture, et cetera, et cetera. I'm serious. No, I mean,
it's hysterical because my name is usually kind of hard for people too, Carlene Montes de Oca. So
yeah, well, no, but
that's a good idea.
Carlene Dio. You know, it's just something simple, and you're right there because you've got some wonderful stuff on there. I can already tell, but I haven't even been there in talking to you, and we want to make sure people get there. Carlin, by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's about our time's up, and I've appreciated your time with us.
Michael Ray, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it.
Oh, my pleasure. Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again. And
I'm Michael Ray.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
I would spend it with you again. But now the curtain falls.